Check my nails, baby. How you feeling? Head toss. Check my nails, baby. How you feeling? Woo, child, tired of the foolish. Gone, dust your shoulders off. Keep it moving, yes, Lord. Step into some new kicks. In there, swimwear, going to the pool quick. Come now, come dry your eyes. You know you a star. You can
welcome everybody. I know that it's hard, but you have. I am, as ever and always, Maggie Dawn, and this is the Maggie Dawn Show. That's Lizzo, in case you've been hiding under an enormous boulder. You are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. As always, you can join our show, 844-967-2789, if you want to watch us do our thing. YouTube, Facebook, we're there. Countdown to the county sales tax vote. It is happening on Thursday. Town halls are going on each and every day. David Crowley is speaking tomorrow. County Executive David Crowley is addressing some folks tomorrow after the break. I'll have the details on that if you want to give your 2 cents on it, because what we're asking for is a half a cent, less than a half a cent of new tax on every dollar spent on consumer goods here in Milwaukee County. What do you get for that half cent for every dollar? You get the fact that we're not going to close senior centers, that we won't shut down bus lines, that your parks and pools will remain open. And no, this is not a problem of our own making. This is a problem of the state's making. The state, which since 2010 has deprived all local governments, not just Milwaukee County or the city, the funding that they need to run. So if you don't know who your supervisor is, if you need some help finding information about this, if you'd like to see the analyses that have been prepared by county stakeholders on this, please don't hesitate to email me. I would be happy to point you in the direction of that information so that you can be informed and so that you can tell your supervisor here in Milwaukee County that they should be voting for the sales tax. You can email me, maggie.dawn@civicmedia.us. You can text the show, Anya. Text or call this show if you want that information. Anya will take your information down. I'll make a personal promise to you to get that to you no later than tomorrow morning. It's that important. It's that important. And the choice is that clear. So not only are we on sales tax countdown, we are on January 6th indictment countdown. We started yesterday's show by letting you know that these things in the news that seem to be so disparate and unconnected are indeed completely connected. That Donald Trump's indictment has to do with a concerted, out-in-the-open GOP effort dating back decades to basically keep people from voting. And not just any people, not folks that may vote Republican, which tend to be older, wealthier, and whiter, to keep poor folks and black and brown folks from voting. That's the out in the open point. That's what the big lie is about. That's what voter integrity is about. And this stuff is in the public record. It's not debatable. And the criminal charges that Donald Trump will be facing, of course, relate to the franchise of black and brown people. Of course they do. Because Donald Trump's campaign didn't challenge the vote counts and object to every ballot cast in Green Lake County. They didn't do it in Kenosha. They didn't do it in any of the northern counties. They did it in Dane and Milwaukee counties. I wonder why that could be. Maybe because there's more brown and black people here that are voting. I mean, sometimes Occam's razor is exactly true, that the most obvious and simple solution or answer to the problem or question is in fact the answer. So too here. And that effort to disenfranchise is, of course, not just about the money, but it relates to distracting all working class Americans from the money. And isn't it timely that we will have here on the Maggie Dawn Show, Erica Payne, along with a friend of hers at the bottom of the hour, to talk about the Great Economy Project, where they are trying to bring information about the money. It's always about the money to all of us, no matter what our political persuasion is. So yes, Trump's indictment relates to voting access, voting equity, which absolutely relates to race in this country and what Mr. Aldean has said in his most disgusting of music videos. And I want to pull that all together for you today because I didn't get there yesterday, and we're going to fit in guests. That's my promise to you. And he's going to help keep me honest about that. Join the conversation, 844-967-2789. So yesterday we got through two of the three charges that we know are going to be in Jack Smith's January 6th indictment of Donald Trump. The first two were conspiracy to commit offense or to defraud the United States, 18 U.S.C. Section 371. This is about the fake electors scheme. This is about the big lie, acting like he didn't know that he lost the election and then trying to fundraise off of it. All of that funnels into this charge. The second charge, again, not in any particular order, is the, quote, tampering with a witness, victim, or an informant, which includes in a subsection obstruction of an official proceeding, obstruction of Congress. That's 18 U.S. Code, Section 1512, sub C, sub 2. I don't think there is a factual case to be made that Donald Trump either actively asked for Congress to be obstructed, see the special hotel, the secret meetings in the hotels leading up to January 6th, and, oh yes, these fake electors and John Eastman and all that. But not only did he actively encourage the obstruction of Congress, but then he failed to stop the obstruction of Congress when he did nothing for those 187 minutes over 3 hours of watching violent attacks on Capitol Police, DC police in our Capitol. And no, folks, Nancy Pelosi did not have the National Guard at the ready. That is not what the factual record shows. And before we got to the end of the show, I had finally gotten to the third charge, which had been the one of some of confusion and different reporting. First, it was reported by Rolling Stone that the third charge was deprivation of rights under color of law, 18 U.S. Code, Section 242. Then the New York Times corrected it late last week that it is actually 18 U.S.C. Section 241, deprivation of rights under color of law. Excuse me, not deprivation of rights under color of law, but conspiracy against rights. So one is about the, we're stopping you from exercising those, and then the other one is effectively a conspiracy to impede your rights. And I want to read this language from conspiracy against rights. If two or more persons conspire to injure, oppress, threaten, or intimidate any person in any state, territory, commonwealth, possession, or district in the free exercise or enjoyment of any right or privilege secured to him by the Constitution or laws of the United States, or because of his or her having so exercised the same, they shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 10 years or both. Yeah, that's what they were trying to do. Hang Mike Pence. If he doesn't take the fake electors, if he doesn't deprive us, wipe away our votes that we've cast in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, in Arizona, in Georgia, in Ohio, in Iowa, it goes on and on. Now, why is this so extraordinarily important? It's important because both sections 241 and 242 were enacted in the wake of the Civil War, specifically to protect Black folks from having their voting and other constitutional rights stripped from them by threat or force, especially given the rise of the KKK and the violent oppression and suppression and scare tactics that were engaged during the civil rights movement of the 60s. So these sections of the U.S. Code are absolutely, explicitly about the rights of Black and brown folks. And we have two cases that tell us a little bit more about what Section 42 is targeted at. The first one, I mentioned this one yesterday, is Pritchard versus the United States. Wasn't able to give you much detail. I can do that today. Pritchard v. U.S., a defendant and his law partner were indicted under Section 241 for a conspiracy to stuff ballot boxes in Bourbon County, Kentucky, during the general election of November 1948. At issue was whether something like ballot box stuffing, which didn't injure any one person in particular, could constitute a violation of Section 241. Here's what the court wrote. It is argued by the defendants that the section, as written, is limited to the protection of the individual rights of citizens and was not intended to vindicate a general interest in the purity of elections. The 254 forged ballots constituted but an infinitesimal fraction of the votes cast in the election and did not affect the outcome of a single contest in any precinct. That this, together with the fact that Bourbon County is traditionally Democratic, shows a complete absence of any intent to affect the outcome of the election. Yeah, the Sixth Circuit rejected that argument as having, quote, no merit. It cited the Supreme Court case in U.S. v. Saylor, which had examined a similarly worded portion of the U.S. Criminal Code. And in that case, in the Saylor case, the Sixth Circuit wrote, quote, the deposit of forged ballots in the ballot boxes, no matter how small or great their number, dilutes the influence of honest votes in an election, and whether in greater or less degree is immaterial. The right to an honest count is a right possessed by each voting elector. That means you and me. And to the extent that the importance of an individual vote is nullified, wholly or in part, the voter has been injured in the free exercise of a right or privilege secured to her by the laws and Constitution of the United States. It matters. It matters a lot. We deserve better than Donald Trump. I'll be back to explain the second case in just a couple of minutes. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked and join us. 844-967-2789. We got to change the lock to our democracy so that nut jobs like Trump can't get a hold of the whole apparatus. 4 years was plenty. Repeat not needed. And here's the thing. I mean, at base, if you're a conservative, like, why continue to defend Donald Trump? You've got a whole bunch of different candidates. They're not all completely bananas. DeSantis is probably worse. But just pick somebody else. Okay, but to return, not to go off on the tangent from the intro song, thank you very much, Anya. What fun, a little Gloria Gaynor this Tuesday afternoon. So, you're talking about 18 U.S.C. Section 241. I shared with you this case where the court absolutely concluded that stuffing a ballot box or attempting to nullify votes, yeah, that's a criminal infraction. It's a crime. Every individual qualified elector deserves to have their ballots counted. Their ballot. And here's why that matters in the Trump indictment. In Georgia, Trump made the phone call to Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger and asked him to go find another 11,780 votes. He's attempting to ballot stuff or nullify some votes. And then across all of the battleground states, you had the Eastman fake elector scheme, which effectively was a request to have Mike Pence nullify hundreds of thousands, millions of duly qualified electors' votes. That is a crime. There was no basis for that. The other case that I mentioned was Doug Mackey, 2016. Mackey, with a whole bunch of other pretty popular Twitter accounts, disseminated fraudulent information encouraging Hillary Clinton's supporters to vote via text message or on social media. Of course, that was invalid. He was convicted. Here's what the DOJ had to say after he was convicted. Mackey has been found guilty by a jury of his peers of attempting to deprive individuals from exercising their sacred right to vote for the candidate of their choice in the 2016 presidential election. Today's verdict proves that the defendant's fraudulent actions crossed a line into criminality and flatly rejects his cynical attempt to use the constitutional right of free speech as a shield for his scheme to subvert the ballot box and suppress the vote. No kidding. Does that sound like it's a description that could fit Donald Trump and all of his co-conspirators? Recall that before the election, Donald Trump and his supporters knowingly spread misinformation about the security and integrity of mail-in ballots. And lo and behold, what just came out this week from the Wisconsin GOP? Anybody? Anybody? Fry? Okay, random Ferris Bueller reference. What came out this week from the Wisconsin GOP was that now they're promoting mail-in ballots. They're promoting absentee ballots. They knew it was a complete line of gobbledygook nonsense in 2020. Now it's just fine. And Trump and his cronies knew that every single time that they asserted that the election was stolen, that that was a lie. Because remember, October 31st, Steve Bannon on tape. Trump has a strategy. Quote, what Trump's going to do is just declare victory, right? He's going to declare victory. But that doesn't mean he's a winner. He's just going to say he's the winner. Now, November 4th, the day after, before all the votes were counted, Trump said this, a very sad group of people is trying to disenfranchise those voters who voted for me, and we won't stand for it. We'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court. He lost all those cases. We want all voting to stop. We don't want them to find any ballots at 4 a.m. and then add them to the list. We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election. A knowing lie. Here's what Kristen Clark, president and executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under Law, said in the aftermath of the 2020 elections. It is difficult for me to think of another president in modern time who has literally driven a national scheme to disenfranchise Black voters and other voters of color en masse in the way that we see with these post-election lawsuits. So yeah, it's about Black and brown voters. It always has been. And here's what. We know that this has always been bogus. This has never been about election integrity. There's no voter fraud at any kind of scale or frequency that would impact a single election for dog catcher, let alone president of the United States. It's a lie. It's a lie that's been perpetrated for well over 20 years. And Republicans have admitted publicly again and again and again that voter ID laws and all these voter integrity laws that they were given permission to enact by the garbage that Trump has spewed are about nothing more than disenfranchising people. How do we know this? Because they say it out loud. They say it in meetings. It's on tape. Back in 2012, when Glenn Grothman was then still a state senator, he said this, Well, now we have photo ID, and I think photo ID is going to make a little bit of difference as well. Yeah, right. I think that we believe that insofar as there are inappropriate things, people who vote inappropriate are more likely to be Democrat. There's no proof of anybody voting inappropriately at any scale. I've got more quotes when we come back, but we're going to be joined by some friends. If you are on the line, I will get to you after our break with our friends. I am Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show. We'll be joined next by Kat and Erica to talk about the Great Economy Project. Join the convo, 844-967-2789. Everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn, and this is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Really excited to be joined again by my good friend. I hope I can call you my good friend now, Erica. Erica Payne with the Great Economy Project with some updates. We were talking about your first event that was happening in Wisconsin a bit ago. But before we get into that and what people can look forward to coming up soon also in Wisconsin, why don't you remind us all a little bit about what the Great Economy Project is?
Absolutely, Maggie. Thank you so much for having me on. So the Great Economy Project, the goal of the Great Economy Project is to get the economy that working people need, regardless of which political party is in charge. And so it's a series of fun dinners with cool, interesting speakers. The subject matter is the economy, the basic structuring of the economy. And we're holding them for... we held about six of them. We had our first one a week or so ago in Wisconsin, and everybody's invited. Everybody in Richland Center is invited. Come on by, have dinner with us. We'll give you a little presentation about what we think is going on with the economy and then what we think we can do to fix it. And hear from folks in Richland Center about what they think about the economy and how what they think we should do to fix it. And the goal is just to get folks together across party lines, set aside, you know, some of the social differences that people have and just focus on money, which is at the end of the day what most political choices are really about. On some level or another, they are talking about money. So let's just talk about money. So the Patriotic Millionaires hosting the Great Economy Project, and we've got a session tomorrow.
Well, we're really excited to have you here to tell people about this. I was curious, what is it that you hear most frequently from regular folks about what's going on in the economy? Like, is there a theme that tends to emerge when you're doing these sessions with people?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that we hear primarily is that people are worried. You know, I mean, they're worried. They're worried, and it doesn't matter if they love Trump or they love Bernie Sanders or they love somebody in between. I mean, folks are worried about the economy. They're worried about the future of their kids. They're worried about inflation. They feel like prices are going up. They feel their wages stagnating. And I think a lot of the folks in the program look around and think, we are about to leave something to our kids that is not what we want. And we just really have to deal with it. And so the idea of the Great Economy Project is to get folks together from small towns, create a way for people to engage with each other about what is actually happening in the way the economy is structured, because this should not be personal. We are the richest country in the world. We've just structured things in such a way that it's making us really unequal, which is making everybody stressed out, which is getting everybody in a fight with everybody else and about to bring down the whole exercise. So let's fix it before it's too late.
What's driving the inequality? when I talk to folks and you start with first principles, one of the first principles or values is, don't we want to feel like we're all being paid fairly, that the tax system works fairly, and that our kids will be better off than we are, right? You go to work. If you work full 40 hours a week, you should be able to live on that, right?
Yeah.
What isn't working? What's going on here? Why is there so much inequality?
Well, and this is what we try to get at in the sessions that we do through the Great Economy Project, is basically what happened. because if you open the newspaper today, you can look at any given newspaper and information that you think is actionable, which is not actually what's happening to the undergirding structure. So you can open your newspaper and say, oh, let's learn about, inflation. Let's learn some more about what the Fed's going to do with the rate hikes. Let's learn something about monopolies and trusts and things like that. There are lots of different factors. But the way the Patriotic Millionaires, which is the group that's hosting this set of dinners, we look at it really as two basic things, the bookends that hold all the books together, and that's wages and taxes, wages and taxes, wages and taxes. Let's start with the basics. And so number one, we have a wage floor that is entirely too low and filled with holes. That's number one. Our minimum wage at the federal level and in Wisconsin is $7.25 an hour. There are millions upon millions of workers who don't actually even get the minimum wage. So some of those are nail salon workers, car wash workers, people who work for tips at restaurants, that kind of thing. We also have—
Can you explain for a second before you move on, Erica, because you've got so much good information. What is problematic? There's many things that are problematic with building tips into a wage structure. Can you hit on maybe two of the things that about tipping as part of a baseline wage structure that helps fuel inequity?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought this up. So how tips work, you know, that, I mean, I was a waitress for like 15 years. You go in, you make $2.13 an hour is the federal tipped wage. Wisconsin follows the federal. So for example, when I was in college, I made $2.13 an hour when I was a cocktail waitress in college. I'm currently 53 years old. And if I got a job today as a waitress, I would—
$2.13 an hour.
So essentially that's zero. Okay. Let's stop pretending that $2 is any kind of wage. So what you're basically doing within a big chunk of your economy, the service industry, think about how many people are employed by the restaurant industry. You're saying to those people, you should work for free. You should deliver the product, sell the product, deliver the product to your customer. And then if they're in a really good mood and for some reason they think you're cute or something else, they should give you some money. And that we think that that should be an appropriate way to structure the wage system for millions of American workers. It is a number of things happen that you can see in academic studies, but some of it's just obvious. I mean, number one, if you're cuter, you get more tips. So that ain't fair. You know, if you flirt with your customers and deal with sexual harassment, your tips probably go up. A bunch of the people who work, the vast majority of people who work in these industries, especially for, the lower end chains, a lot of the upper end chains are white males, but a lot of the people who work at regular restaurants are women.
Supper clubs and steak joints. When's the last time you saw a woman in a bow tie with the long apron on in the steak joint that is your favorite? It's mostly guys over the age of 40. Sorry to interrupt, Erica.
Well, no, and that's 100% right. And that's true across the industry, across the nation. And so what we've basically done is set up a system where we're allowing one industry compared to other industries to basically pay their workers nothing. Okay. Now they legally are supposed to make up the tips. If you don't get up to $7.25, you're supposed to say to your manager, make that up for me. As a former waitress, I will tell you that basically
never happens
because how are, your manager, you bitch enough, the manager is going to move you from the Saturday night dinner shift to the Monday morning breakfast shift. So that's not going to happen.
Who are you complaining? We have a crappy shift. Let's see how that goes for you.
Oh, that's exactly right. And you're in a situation where, during the pandemic, particularly, we put folks in a horrible position because we were basically saying to our wait staff, first of all, enforce mask rules if you have them. Number two, enforce social distancing. So everybody's in a bad mood anyway. And then you're relying on these folks that you're trying to enforce a bunch of rules on to decide whether or not you can make a living and pay your kids. And so our theory about this case is, look, we know that we have an economic problem. We have a consumer demand-driven economy. 70% of the activity in our economy comes from consumers. So let's ensure that we have a wage structure that provides a decent living for people as a matter of law, and then put tips on top of that. Okay,
it's actually a tip.
That's right, where it's actually a tip as opposed to here's your base wage.
And I always like to draw a comparison. and say, oh, you know what everybody basically thinks is garbage is CEO pay. So CEO pay, and I know that you all deal with this, but just to draw a really simple and intuitive comparison, many CEOs have performance adjusted comp, but a lot of them have base comp, base compensation that is not performance driven. In other words, they are guaranteed multi-million dollar compensation, regardless of how the business is doing, regardless of the return to investors or the quality of the product that gets put out. And oftentimes when CEOs are fired because they've done such a crappy job, they're given a bonus as they're seen out the door. So I find it entirely disingenuous that we are willing to tolerate underperformance with overpay in certain sectors of our economy. But when it comes to who's bringing my food or helping me in certain consumer transactions, all of a sudden it's, well, I'm always right, they're always wrong, and unless they've got a smile and a spring in their step, screw them, I won't give them a tip.
Well, and tips went down. Listen, when people are under economic pressure, tips go down. And so the idea is really, how do we build an economy that is going to work for the next 250 years of American history? And we believe that it would be much more straightforward. You're going to have much less issue with wage theft, much less issue with people working completely off the clock. You have to pay people a living wage, okay? Whatever the base wage is that your state decides on or that the federal does, you have to pay that base wage. You can't have these exemptions for tipping. And then you put tips on top of that. And the restaurant is then operating as a team. So there are about 6,000 restaurants around the country who do one fair wage. There are nine states that already are at one fair wage, meaning you get paid a wage and then you get tips on top. Here's the thing to know about these states. They do better in terms of restaurant openings. They do better in terms of tip size. They do better. All of the research shows that this is the way to go. And if you think about it as a waitress, if your check is higher, your tip's going to be higher. America has a culture of tipping, and we're not going to eliminate that culture of tipping by the fact that we give people a base wage and tips on top. It'll cut down a lot of abuse. And I think that we're at a place in the United States where we just want to make things clean and easy and get some of the basics working again. And so that really starts with a wage floor that encompasses everybody and that has as a rule, it's a cost of living. What we would like to see is a cost of living wage. If you work for 40 hours, you should be able as a single person to meet your basic needs.
And that's it. To me, it's one of the interesting things because I consider myself an economist because I've done that quant degree work. People look at me, well, how do we possibly figure out what a minimum wage is? And I was like, well, how many hours in a week should someone work? And we can say it's 40 or 50. I've worked 80-hour weeks, right? We all have done extraordinary workloads. And you look at what the basket of goods that a household consumes is, and we know how much those things cost. We know how much housing costs in a region, how much healthcare costs, food, all that stuff. You add it up. You assume 2 weeks of vacation a year, 50 weeks and 40 hours, it's math. Like the math works.
It's absolutely math. And there's a tool called the MIT. It was created at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the Massachusetts MIT Living Wage Calculator. You can just Google it. But if you want to know exactly what the cost of living is and then what they're allocating for housing and everything else, just Google MIT Living Wage Calculator and you can go check out what it means. But the gap between the base wage that is legally allowed to pay somebody and the amount it costs to live anywhere in the United States is a gaping hole that millions of Americans are falling through. And as you said, Maggie, there's math on this exam.
Yes.
And, you know, I personally don't mind working 50, 60, 70 hours a week sometimes, but the fact is I have an 8-year-old and we have children to raise and we have lives to live and there is one life on this earth and 40 hours is plenty to put into supporting your family and the rest needs to go to your kids, your community, working in the schools, doing the other things that make a life.
And we know that there's enough money in the economy to support this.
Well, there's not only enough money in the economy. The fact that we're not delivering it into the pockets of workers is really dumb. Because let me tell you this. If you walk into somebody making, you know, less than call it $40,000 or $50,000 a year, you give them, hand them $20. You know what they're going to go do? They're going to go spend it on something their family needs. And so that's what happens when you get money into these working
consumers.
They spend it because they need it for food, and it stimulates the economy and it does better for everybody.
That is the tipping point that's out there, everybody. It's the Great Economy Project. Where should they go tomorrow?
Yes. So we are so excited. Come to Phoenix Center. We have a very cool presentation about CEO pay. It is going to blow your head apart. Come have free dinner on us. It'll last about an hour and a half. Show up at 5:30. Open doors. We'll have a great dinner for you. The Phoenix Center. Pick up a bowling game before. We'd love to see you. It's going to
awesome. Be fun. Tomorrow in Richland Center.
Last week, Maggie.
Yeah. Tomorrow in Richland Center, in the Phoenix Center, 5:30. Be there or be square. Let's learn how to start fairly compensating the average working folks. Thank you, Erica. We'll be back with more. Get on that train. We can all have happiness. It is based in a fair wage. Don't we all deserve to be compensated fairly for a day's work? What is fair? Enough to live on if you're willing to work full time and work hard. Period. Full stop. This is a solvable problem, and there's plenty of wealth out there to do this. My thanks to my friend texting out of Northbrook, Illinois, coming along for the mind journey. I think our friend from Northbrook, Illinois thought I was going to say some crazy stuff because they heard I was an economist. Most people hate economists. Keep listening because these are solvable problems. For all you that are interested, not only just in the Great Economy Project and Patriotic Millionaires, all that stuff you can Google, I've got a great, great, great book for you. It's written by a Nobel laureate in economics, and it's called Good Economics for Hard Times. Talks about every single big problem that the globe faces right now. And good economists are humble economists that speak in language that everybody can understand. If you're talking to an economist and they give you a bunch of nonsense, they either don't know what they're talking about, or they're trying to distract you because they don't actually want to talk about where the money's going. I promised I would get to the phone lines because we've been talking about the Trump indictment. We've been talking about the fact that the Trump indictment at base, at root, is functionally simply a symptom of the cancer that is rotting our democracy. And that is the decades-long conservative attempt to disenfranchise Black and brown people and anybody that might vote Democratic. There is no voter fraud except for the voter fraud that's perpetrated by people like Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump and John Eastman because they want to take away your vote, your legally cast vote, and toss it aside. That's the voter fraud. Mark from the SAC, you're up. Keep it quick because I want to get a couple more factoids in here before we lose the rest of the hour. Thank you for holding on and listening.
Yeah, thanks so much. And what you're pointing out is absolutely accurate. If we would have kept up what happened after the Civil War and Reconstruction and not had that rolled back, we'd be in a whole different situation today. And the fact that none of these Republicans out there are condemning the efforts to overturn the election, condemning the fake electors, means that they don't take their oath to the Constitution very seriously at all. And they need to be called out on that because they betrayed their oath to the Constitution. Mike Pence included. He did not condemn the actions of Donald Trump, and he still has not condemned the actions of Donald Trump, and Donald Trump offered, his supporters offered to hang him. So enough said. Thanks so much.
I appreciate you, Mark, as ever and always. 2012, 2013, Pennsylvania GOP Chairman Robert Gleason said this. We had a better election. Think about this week, and this is in response to Pennsylvania's voter ID law. We cut Obama by 5%, which was big. A lot of people lost sight of that. He beat McCain by 10%, but he only beat Romney by 5%, and photo ID helped a little bit in that. And then there's this. If you haven't seen this clip, you can go find it. Daily Show 2013, North Carolina GOP precinct chairman, said he was okay with it if voter ID prevented, quote, lazy blacks from voting. It is the quiet part out loud. The law is going to kick the Democrats in the butt, Don Yelton added. That's the guy's name. 2013, Don Yelton, Daily Show. He was later forced out of his position. Now they don't care so much. Robert Spindell, Bob Spindell, co-conspirator. He's a member of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Proud peacock of the work that Republicans have done to disenfranchise and disengage black voters, especially in Milwaukee. He wrote this in the city of Milwaukee with the force. This is about the November 2022 election. He wrote this in the city of Milwaukee with the 4th Congressional District Republican Party working very closely with the RPW, RNC, blah, 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 blah. In the black and Hispanic areas, we can be especially proud of the city of Milwaukee casting 37,000 less votes than in 2018. I'm going to read that again. Robert Spindell, Wisconsin Elections Commissioner and GOP operative in the city of Milwaukee. In the black and Hispanic areas, we can be especially proud of Milwaukee casting 37,000 less votes than in 2018, with the major reduction happening in the overwhelmingly black and Hispanic areas. This great and important decrease in Democratic votes in the city was due to a well-thought-out and multifaceted plan. This plan has been executed and architected by a place that we may all be very familiar with. It's the Heritage Foundation. It was founded in 1973 by a guy named Paul Weyrich, conservative activist. He was also the Heritage Foundation's first president. Oh, and he went on to co-found ALEC. You know, that place that cedes legislation to every state legislature in the country, who's come up with all of this garbage. You can't absentee vote. There's no drop boxes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Here's the list of stuff they hate because it makes it easier for people to vote. Mailbox drop boxes, sending absentee ballot request forms to voters, making it easier for partisan workers to monitor the polls, read, intimidate voters, preventing the collection of mail-in ballots, restricting the ability of counties to accept donations from nonprofit groups seeking to aid in election administration. I can go on. Speaking in 1980 at a meeting of evangelical leaders in Dallas, Weyrich, the founder of ALEC and the Heritage Foundation, bluntly articulated his radical views on voting rights. Please listen to what I'm about to say, because this was the quiet part out loud in 1980. Speaking in 1980 at a meeting of evangelical leaders in Dallas, Weyrich, the founder of the Heritage Foundation and ALEC, said this: I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of the people. They never have been from the beginning of our country. Yeah. Okay. That would be it. It's always been about keeping black and brown folks out of the voting box, out of the ballot box. There's no way to deny that with any integrity at all. That's it for this edition of the Maggie Dawn Show. Tomorrow I'm going to paint you a picture. I'm going to paint you a picture about why what Mr. Aldean is singing, while he enjoys a First Amendment right to sing it, is disgusting and revolting. Tune in tomorrow. Thanks for listening. I'm Maggie Dawn. This has been the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network.